paintings, Twilight in the Wilderness, The Icebergs, form, in essence, a series. There are 10 or 12 of them that go from 1859 through the 1860s as Church literally catalogs the entire sort of exotic beauty of the natural world as fast as he could find it. He moved on from America and the icebergs to portray the most dramatic of all South American volcanoes. And again, these are all very, very large, intricate, exquisitely painted pictures. This is the famous painting of Cotopaxi in eruption as the sun rises over this high mountain lake. An extraordinary achievement. He also painted again in the far north one of his most dramatic paintings of the Aurora Borealis, which he had literally actually witnessed, and this extraordinary landscape with an exploratory scientific mission schooner here frozen in for the winter on this expedition. And this, painted in 1865, interestingly enough, was seen by many of Church's contemporaries as a prophetic symbol that the war was soon going to end, because as you may know, in 1865 there was a particularly dramatic display of the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, and many Americans saw that display as a kind of sign that the North would prevail, the Northern Lights being so dramatic. Church then moved on, ever exploring farther and farther afield to Jamaica, again, where no other artist had gone, and he painted these two, again, quite exceptional works. This one called The Veil of St. Thomas, this name for not only the valley here, but for this effect of mist, which seemed to make a kind of veil passing over the landscape. And in one of his least known, but I think most extraordinary landscapes, a scene of a ruined colonial church in Jamaica, when Church, the artist, saw this extraordinary effect of the sun having just gone below this bank of clouds beyond the mountains, where these great rays of light shone up into the sky. It's an exceptional, again, very little known painting, but one of this series of a kind of catalog of the most extraordinary parts of the world that Church could get to. The problem that Church found in the later 1860s, after the Civil War, is that because of the cultural upheaval of that event, because of the changing taste in America, and because in particular that Americans were beginning to feel that the Civil War had been such a blow to the American national identity that they needed to look abroad, that many American patrons, critics, and writers about art began to find Church and his contemporaries old-fashioned. They wanted a newer style of art. They wanted French painting. They wanted Americans to train in France or in England or in Germany. And Church gradually found that his kind of landscape was going out of favor. He didn't give up. He traveled even farther afield. He went to the Old World, where he painted this very, very lovely painting of the Parthenon. He went to the Holy Land, where he painted this great view of Jerusalem with the Dome of the Rock from the Mount of Olives. He began to look now if American nature and New World nature had lost its currency, had lost its ability to speak to Americans of his day. Church now began to look to other places, to the Old World, to the land of the Bible, to the land of antiquity. But increasingly, Church realized that his own life was no longer in the center of New York and American cultural activities. And he began, increasingly by the late 1860s, and particularly in the 1870s and 80s, to devote himself to what in reality is the last great achievement of his career, and that was his house, Olana, which was built on a mountain, or a small mountain, a hill about 500 feet high, overlooking the Hudson. This is the Hudson, and here's a view from the top right here, looking out directly across the Hudson from Catskill, New York, which is where Church had studied with Thomas Cole when he was a pupil. He bought this property, built this extraordinary kind of combination, Moorish, Persian, Gothic mansion there, and then set about creating his own landscape. He planted trees, he built this lake, he cut vistas. Much of this is now grown up, so it's difficult to understand how it was in Church's day. He created his own landscape when he realized that his painted landscapes no longer could speak to Americans the same way they had 20 years before. He wrote to a friend, a sculptor, Erastus Dow Palmer. He said, "About an hour south of Albany is the center of the world, and I own it." So Church had realized that his day had passed, but he never lost that creative urge to do something with landscape. Olana, by the way, is now open to the public. It's part of the New York State Park System. You can go take a tour of the house, and it's a constant. I've been there probably 30 or 40 times, and every time it's amazing to me because he created views through windows, through veranda. He bought back many of his paintings and made them as a kind of history of his career. He made wonderful whimsical touches, such as these little finials up on the very top of the tower, which if you can get all the way up there, which is a long climb and not open to the public, I'm afraid, once you get up there, you see their teapots that he just stuck up there. It's an extraordinary achievement, and one, if you're ever in New York State in that way, I highly urge you to go see it. I said, though, that Olana was in some ways Church's last great achievement. He didn't stop painting altogether. He painted less and less the grand style of landscape that I've showed you tonight, but he did in one last instance create what I think is an extraordinary kind of final summing up of his career. This is a work in the National Gallery called Morning in the Tropics from 1877. This painting is actually now in the conservation lab at the gallery being cleaned, and it's a revelation to all of us at the gallery who've known it for years, because it's proving that, in fact, Church, to the late years of his career, was every bit as skilled technically and as capable of achievement as he had been 30 years earlier, because much of it's been discolored and disfigured and obscured by varnish that's gone bad. So you're seeing it, unfortunately, here in its old state. It's only half clean now. But what Church did in this last great work, this last vision of the tropics, he hadn't been to South America now for over 20 years, was, I think, create as his last full-scale, successful landscape, a very, very personal vision of the South American, the New World landscape. It's morning in the tropics. You sense that light has just dawned. The sun is not too far up. The mist is burning off of the river. It's the sense that the landscape has become refreshed and that it's almost like looking at the world as it must have been at creation. And as you look at this landscape, which again, the physical size of it is huge, you're inevitably drawn into it. It's as if you could step right onto this space in the foreground and imagine yourself here. And as you look at the landscape and are drawn into it, it's a very seductive, beautiful, evocative picture. As you look at it, you see way off in the distance, which is just a spot here for you on the screen, but you can see gradually your eyes become accustomed to the mist. You see that here is a tiny figure in a boat who is disappearing into that mist that's radiant with light. And I have no doubt in my mind that for Church, now at his own old age, at the end of his career, that he's thinking back to his teacher's work, The Voyage of Life, where in the final painting, the voyager has reached the end of his career on a river, literally, that leads into this great stream of light into the heavens. And that Church here took one last opportunity to show that landscape painting, again, could be the vehicle for messages of profound significance and ultimately, I think, challenging to those of us who see them today. I invite you to come to the National Gallery in October of next year, in 1989, when we will have an exhibition of Frederick Church's most important works, and all of the paintings that I've shown you tonight will be included in that show. And it will be an opportunity that, I can assure you, will only come once in our lifetime. So I hope to see you then, and I thank you for your attention tonight. That's a good question. Can you hear me before we go back to the mic? It's difficult to know, because that's the sort of documentation often an artist doesn't leave us. He leaves us sketches, he leaves us drawings. But in the case of the Heart of the Andes, we do have a good idea, because I've spent, as have others, a lot of time going through 19th century newspapers. And if you begin to look in the right places in 19th century newspapers, there are little references to what major artists are doing. And one of the things you find is that Church, when he was working on a major work, tended to shut the door and not let any people come in and bother him. We do know that he worked sometimes 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we also know that the Heart of the Andes, from the beginning of the big canvas — this isn't saying how long he worked sort of on the idea — took him 9 months of painting. Now, that is probably the most he ever worked on a single work, because it's the largest, the most detailed, the most technically complex. We also know the other side of the coin is that he painted a work which is unfortunately lost, which was called Under Niagara, a view of Niagara Falls from the Maid of the Mist, which the boat which you can still take today if you're so inclined, which showed the water literally coming down from above. We know that he painted that in 6 hours as a kind of demonstration of what he could do when he wanted to. Now, surely it wasn't as detailed as the Niagara I showed you, but I've seen a print made from the painting, and it was a remarkable achievement. Do you remember the sketch that I showed you, a small one of the waves breaking on the shore at Mount Desert? I would guess that painting is about like this. It's one of those works, when you see it, it's a marvel of just technical achievement, because he painted a ground color, a kind of salmon color. Then he built up from that the rocks, so that you see the salmon showing through the rocks, and then the sand is the same color, the understructure of the sky. He knew exactly what he was doing. He probably painted a picture like that in a matter of about an hour or two, sitting right there looking at the scene. He literally — there's no painter that technically and just in sheer physical ability was the equal of Church until Winslow Homer. And they're very different painters. But Cole knew it. Cole, when Church came to study with him, the first thing Cole said was, "Would you please teach my children how to draw, because you're better than I am." He's one of those talents that comes along out of nowhere. And he's an artist, interestingly enough, that I think in some ways it was a perfect coincidence that he came to the height of his powers in the 1850s, because it was the very moment when America perhaps was ready to make the most of an artist like that. It was a perfect time. It's out there somewhere, I suspect. It's lost. The icebergs, the big picture I showed you, that was lost for 100 years. And the clue was right there for all of us to see, but we never followed it up. There was a 19th century English book, a dictionary about artists, and it had Church in there, and it mentioned his principal works. And we knew that the icebergs had been sent to England, where many of Church's paintings were exhibited. This book said that the icebergs had been purchased by a man named Sir somebody Watkins. And That one reference was so obscure, no one that was interested in church had ever come across it. But if you had, you could have gone in 1979 to the house that that man built in 1863, and you would have found way up on the attic, because the house had been turned into a boys' school, you would have found the painting. There it was. And someone did, and they sent it to New York in 1979, and it was auctioned for $2.5 million. So these things happen, believe me. There are some other great churches lost. Some of them may have been destroyed, you never know. That happens. We're fortunate with Church in that virtually all of his major works have survived. But every now and then, well, not so infrequently, I'd say two or three times a month, photographs arrive in the mail of hopeful churches, and I'd say I've come across three or four in my life, so I've never actually come across one that I could buy, but I've seen others that people have found. So. Any other questions? Yes. The icebergs in 1979 it set a record at the time. My own institution subsequently broke that record. In 1985, we purchased at auction a painting by Rembrandt Peel of his brother, Rubens Peel, with a geranium. Doesn't sound like a record breaker, but that's what happens. Of course, $2.5 million is nothing now when Van Gogh's go for 55 and Jasper John's go for 17 million. So it's there has recently been a Frederick Church, which the last, I didn't show it to you tonight, the last major one in private hands, which remained in the family that commissioned it, recently was sold to a museum in California. And they made no secret of the price, which was in the neighborhood of $5 million. And I think they got a bargain, personally, because it's not an opportunity that's going to come again, unless one of these long-lost ones turns up again. Yes? There is, in print, I will not push my own book. there's a wonderful book from 1966 by Professor David Huntington, who was the first person to work seriously on Church. It's not in print, unfortunately, but it's a very good look at Church's whole career and a biography of him. I'm hoping that the exhibition catalog that we'll do for the show at the National Gallery will fill a kind of need for a basic book on Church with lots of illustrations and a detailed chronology of his life. Somebody in the back also had a question? Yes?
I'd like to know whether the last painting seems to be sort of magically dreamed by. And the waterfall and everything before that is quite magically realistic.
Yes. Well, it's probably not as abrupt as it seemed on the screen, because I kind of edited out a lot that went. I mean, actually, much of his attention between, say, Niagara, the waterfall picture, or the Heart of the Andes, much of his attention was devoted to Olana, building Olana, and he painted less. The last painting I showed you was almost 20 years after the Heart of the Andes. What had happened, I think, was a combination of his own recognition that times had changed, also his recognition that art had changed. 1877, when Morning in the Tropics was painted, is when another painter who was his exact contemporary, George Innes, was the most famous American painter of the day. And if you know Innes's works, they're much softer. There's some in the museum, the Brooks Museum. You can look at a good example there. They're more suggestive. The old style, pre-Civil War style of naturalism, of realism, had been basically sort of overturned as old-fashioned. So in one sense, Church was adapting to that, but not, I don't think he was repudiating his earlier style. I think that the sort of suggestiveness and softness and mystery of Morning in the Tropics relate as much to Church's own psychological sort of needs for what he wanted the painting to do. What is what? I have two, actually. I have one that just came out, which is called Frederick Edwin Church and the National Landscape, which is mainly about his American, North American landscapes and how those landscapes fit into this idea of nationalist pride. There should be, in fact, in the next couple of years, a number of books coming out on church. There's a curator at the Met who's writing a kind of life and works of church, which will be, I think, a very good basic survey of the artist's work. Yes? He did not, interestingly enough, ever go to the American West. That's a fascinating thing, because at one moment in Church's career, about 1859, after the Heart of the Andes, there's rumor in the newspapers that he's looking around for new subject matter. It's rumored that he's going to the far north to paint the icebergs, which is in fact what he does. But another rumor is that he's going to go to the west, to the Rockies. That rumor, in fact, Church, is, as best I can tell, never seriously considered going to the Rockies, because another artist, slightly younger man, very, very ambitious man named Albert Bierstadt, was already there. In 1859, he was in the Rockies with a government surveying party, and Bierstadt, Church, I think, perfectly well knew, had beaten him. You know, he was there and was going to come back and do it. And in fact, Bierstadt came back and took a leaf out of Church's book and started painting those enormous views of the Rockies and places like that that made him famous. Now, in terms of other countries, Church did go to Italy, but he found it uninspiring for some reason. He painted a lot of Near Eastern landscapes. I showed you the Parthenon and Jerusalem, but he did another others. He did some wonderful paintings of what is now present-day Jordan. Let's see. He traveled in Mexico late in life and did a lot of oil sketches. He got fascinated late in life with architecture and did oil sketches of Mexican colonial churches. He's fascinated all through his life, churches over and over again. I think that's about it. Yeah. Yes?
I'm fascinated that you have not once used the term luminosity, and I thought the theory of Cold Spring Church was the luminous theory that made such a contribution.
Well, that's, luminism is a term which is actually a fairly controversial one, because the question is, for many historians of this period, is what seems to us a binding thread in the interest in light, the luminous qualities of these landscapes, is that our perception of something that's really what they intended, or is it purely, you know, one aspect of their paintings that really should be seen with lots of other aspects? There's a lot of revisionist thinking going on right now as to what really is or isn't luminous painting. Church is often sort of put squarely in the middle of it, and sometimes he's put outside of it. I'm one of those people who tends to take a rather restrictive view and argue that really what we're looking at in mid-19th century American landscape is what was called the Hudson River School, and that within the Hudson River School you had a whole variety of expressions. Church was one great high moment of expression, and that other artists such as Fitzhugh Lane and Martin Johnson Heed, lesser known painters today, but important in their day, they went down a kind of art which was in some ways different than Church's, which was the more purely luminous type of painting. It is a very controversial idea, and it's one that the great show in the National Gallery in 1980 called American Light, the Luminous Movement, reintroduced many of these painters, I think, to popular consciousness, and in that sense did a wonderful service, but in another sense kind of brought together a whole lot of painters into one great bag which they don't all necessarily fit into. But I personally don't think of Church as a luminist in the technical sense, although his paintings are, they're all about light, and I mean obviously about light, as well as were many paintings done in many other countries. If you know German Romantic landscape painting, if you know the work of Caspar David Friedrich or some of his contemporaries, they're very similar. There's no sense that Friedrich and Church would have known one another's works, because they clearly didn't, but they expressed similar ideals, at which light was an overriding concern. Right. It's Immanuel Kant, yes. Oh, you're thinking of Burke, the sublime. Yes. Oh, right. Oh, I know. Yeah, Monk. I know Monk's book on the sublime, sure. I thought you were talking about the 17th century writers. Oh, sure. I didn't know he taught at Rhodes, though. Artistic theory, particularly the sublime, the beautiful, and the picturesque, which were types of landscape, were really crucial in the formation of American landscape style, because America really was so deeply attached to England, even in the period after independence, in terms of received cultural values, that the very ways of looking at landscape and understanding it came out of many of those aesthetic traditions, of which the sublime would be the style of landscape. Those early ones with the blasted trees and the rocks and the storms, those are the more traditional sublime landscape.
One more. Let me thank you again.
Pleasure.